So
I've never done a Twitch before. I'm very excited.
Yeah, Twitch, it was different. Nobody else was really doing it. I've had a few. It's a weird setup because, again, Twitch is not where most people go for their author events. Going to go ahead and get into the intro. Obviously, anybody who is not familiar with you, we're going to be here for a minute. Just letting you know that now. All right.
I'll get comfy.
Exactly. Born in North Carolina, raised in Arizona, where he had the misfortune to go to Horizon High School. I grew up in Phoenix. Sorry. Paradise Valley. I had to throw that out there.
I grew up around the corner from Paradise
Valley.
Exactly.
Yep.
In my school.
I saw Horizon. I was like, I know where that's at.
I grew up on 32nd and Bell. So Paradise Valley was like right around the corner. But yep. We chose to go to the better school.
Fair enough. Yeah. I think 7th Street and Union Hills was where I was at. So very, very close. We were not that too far away. Different years, I'm sure. But. Anyhow, so you grew up in Arizona, and then you are now residing in New York City. Nat Cassidy is, let me clear my throat for a second, an award-winning playwright, director, actor, and musician. Nat has appeared in television shows like Blue Bloods, love it, Bull, The Following, oh my goodness, I love that show. I did get in trouble with my daughter, though, for not letting her know about the dog in the first episode. She's a big dog fan. I was in much trouble. You were in The Good Fight, seen that, Quantico, The Affair. Pretty much you're in a bunch of stuff I've seen. Red Oaks, The Last OG, High Maintenance, which was an original web series, as well as on stage at venues such as the Lincoln Center, Cherry Lane, The Publix, Soho Playhouse, Classic Stage Companies, East 13th Street Theater, The Arclight, 59 East 59, Theater Row, PS 133, Manhattan, Theater Source, The Gallery Players, 45th Street Theater, The Play Theater, or so the Players Theater, the Players Club, and many others. And the fact that there's many others on the list of that just tells you just how busy he's been. Nat is also, and I quote, one of New York City's rising playwrights with numerous productions and awards, critical acclaims, and a reputation for producing intelligent, bold, darkly comic plays with one foot in horror and the other in literary illusions, according to Usher Nonsense. By the way, Usher Nonsense, I love the name. I did say, and I didn't write it down, and of course, do you think I could find it now? I did see when I was looking up one of your things, and I can't quote the person because I can't remember exactly who said it, but you were listed one of your shows. I think it was an indie, and they said that basically your acting carried that movie, which I thought was...
We Will Outlive Us All, which is basically a two-hander, and the other hander is also phenomenal, so... I won't claim to carry that movie, but that is a great movie.
Somebody said that you were worth watching it just for you. So perfect. And apparently
I apologize. You have the like long form of my bio too.
I do. So
feel free to skip around if you want.
Well, it's one of those things where I've always shortened the bio and then I finally realize it's like, am I cutting some people short, you know, not giving them all the information? But yeah, so like obviously a lot of screenplays. You've been off Broadway. You've been off Broadway. So I won't go through all of those because, again, you also do have a lot of the and others. But you are also not just an actor. You're also a musician. Nat and the Nines, if I remember correctly. Yep, Nat Cassidy and the Nines.
Nat Cassidy and the Nines, yep.
Wrote two albums so far, working on 3, 4, and 5. Is that still up to date?
Sort of. Everything is, I would say 3, 4, and 5 are done, but they have not been recorded.
So which is, you know, well, part, again, that's a small piece that needs to be done there.
Yeah. So do they exist? I don't know.
It's somewhere. It's Schrodinger's cat. Maybe.
Exactly.
We'll find out.
They're the best albums you'll never hear.
Exactly. If there's a better album, you didn't write it, right? Exactly.
Not yet.
But then, of course, we are here talking to you today as you are an author. As I mentioned before, I did have the audiobook, so I don't have your book to put up anywhere, but it was Nestlings. I keep wanting to put a the in front of it. Nestlings, perfect, exactly. Comes out on Halloween, which is perfect because I didn't want to pigeonhole it, but I kind of had this listed as it's kind of a haunted house, but it's a twist.
Yeah.
It's not a normal haunted house. But yeah, I absolutely love that book. So going over a few questions here.
Hi, everybody.
Yes, exactly. Well, again, some people sneaking in hopefully here pretty soon. So you write screenplays, you write novels, you write music. Do you find that having those skills intertwine and help each other? Or do you feel like they are definitely like right now I'm a musician, right now I'm a screenwriter, sorry, right now I'm a novelist. Are they completely separate skill sets?
That's a great question. I find that they are more complementary than exclusionary. Each one obviously has like its own specific quirks and stuff like that. Like I'm not, you know, trying to think of music theory when I'm writing a screenplay or something like that. And like, you know, when you're writing a screenplay or something like that, there's a lot of formatting constraints that you need to right. keep in mind and concision and stuff like that. So each one has its own discipline set, but ultimately, I mean, your job is to make your audience, be they a reader or a listener, or, you know, someone who's attending one of your plays or someone who's reading a book or listening to the audiobook or something like that. Your job is to make them want to get to the next sentence. So that is kind of the same job across the board. And, you know, you learn little tricks for each one that can help you in that endeavor. But I think there are a few aspects that, like, actually feed into each other from each discipline. Like, I'm a very rhythmical writer. Like, my prose, I think, is very rhythmic. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, comes from the music background. I tend to write very descriptive stage directions and action slugs and stuff like that, which comes from like the prose writing side and stuff like that. And the way I tend to break scenes and, you know, the sort of dramaturgy that I'm most comfortable with comes from my playwriting background. And I love like dialogue heavy and I love character heavy things. So anything that I write, I tend to approach from a characterological sort of place, and like, you know, how is this character changing through this scene, and how is this character physically feeling, and how does their body affect their emotional state? And that all comes from my acting training. Mm-hmm. So they all kind of like feed into each other in a weird little mishmash. But I think it works.
No, it does. Like I said, I definitely saw different parts of you in this novel, which I think helped it kind of stand aside, or, you know, stand out from the normal horror book you get. From the time that you sat down and put pen to paper on this novel, not to the time it was published, because, you know, publishing dates get moved around, but the time you were done editing it, it's off, your hands are clean. About how long did it take you to write this?
It is such an interesting thing. So my book before this, Mary? I had a two-book contract, Mary, yeah. Yep. Mary was a book that I first wrote when I was like 13, and then like rebroke it over several different media, kept coming back to it. Like, I have a ton of other stories and scripts and stuff like that, but I couldn't let Mary go over my, you know, several years longer than 13 years old, let's say, just a couple of decades. Yep. And so I kept coming back to this story and rebroke it over and over and over again, and then got a contract to write the novel version that actually came out, the version that exists. I signed that contract in, I want to say, 2019. And that book came out finally in 2022. So that was, if you include the other versions that came before it, that was several decades to work on that that story. And that, you know, that final version proper, that was like 3 years from beginning to publication. And then with Nestlings, I did not have that much time that I had with Mary. But we picked Nestlings. I say this because this is a fun little window into the into publishing, into like traditional publishing and how slow it can move. We picked Nestlings as the follow-up to Mary a couple of months after Parasite won the Oscar, which I think
gotcha.
Was 2021, I want to say.
Yeah, it's been a while.
2020. Yeah, it's been a while, because the Nightfire liked that, you know, Parasite was all about like, you know, class consciousness, and it was a thriller that was set in a very like locational, an exciting location and a very like interesting location. And it was about, you know, the lower class and the upper class and the differentiations that they might have. So they were like, great, let's do this, this apartment complex novel. Cut to 2023 when it's finally coming out. But it did not take that long to write. I finished Mary eventually around 2021, started working on Nestlings and in 2021. And then I think somewhere along the process, we knew we were going to have a late October publication date. And so in order to meet that, the book kind of has to be, for all intents and purposes, done, like several drafts, revisions, polished, You still have your like your copy edits and stuff like that, but it needs to be done like about a year out so that they can start up the marketing machinery and the art machinery and all that stuff. So I think I finished the first draft in December of 2021. So that probably took like 9 months. And then second draft, third draft, polish, all of that stuff up until around October of 2022. And then it's out of your hands. And then you just, like, my next book has like maybe one revision, one or two revisions. It's in really good shape for a first draft. And like the bones are all there. There's just like a couple of scenes I need to like tweak or add and you know, polish up the language and stuff like that. And if, so for all intents and purposes, it's done. It's not coming out until middle of 2025. Like publishing just moves slow. It moves at its own rate.
It does. It definitely does. There's a few outliers there. I know I talked to Sarah Kozlov. She had a weird one where she dropped 4 books in 4 months.
Oof.
But that means she also had to have them all written before that. So there's...
Yeah. My first book actually was kind of similar to that. My first, it was a novelization of a podcast that I also produced and was in, or I co-produced and was in. And that was my first published book. And I didn't write the script, but I wrote the novelization of the script and Tor Books basically co-produced the audio drama and were like, we want to release a novelization of this. Does one of you on the production team want to write the novelization? And I was like, I will. So literally as the writer of the audio drama was turning in the scripts, which hadn't been written yet, I was novelizing them basically hot off the presses. And from page one, first draft to publication, I think the whole thing was about 4 months. It was insanely fast.
Yeah.
So I have a
that doesn't happen too often.
No, it was rough, but it was also kind of fun. There was no time to overthink it.
So a couple of questions about the writing. First of all, who was your favorite character to write? And I've found that it's not usually the main character for most authors.
That's a good question. I mean, as you know, having listened to it, it's a very personal story. It's kind of a uniquely personal story because it kind of dramatizes and takes a lot of liberties. But
it's a horror.
It's a horror novel. And it's the characters are very much not me and my wife, but it's about the horrible year that me and my wife went through. So it's about like some of the emotional landscape that we traversed. Mm-hmm. But so every character, or almost every character, at least signifies an actual person that was on that journey with us or that we encountered. So I kind of got a kick out of everybody. I mean, there are some that I like a little bit more than others, like the Anna and Reed, I think, are still like probably my favorite overall because I found them to be very rich and interesting, and I liked when they fought. I just really liked writing those scenes and exploring those scenes. But pretty close thereafter, the character of Georgia O'Keefe, mm-hmm. who's not the painter but a physical therapist, is based on I went to high school with a girl named Georgia O'Keefe, so that was kind of my homage to her. She was a lot of fun. She changed a lot during the drafting because she was a much different character in the first draft than the final character that we get to know. But I liked her a lot. There were a couple of other characters that actually didn't survive the drafting process that were a lot of fun. There was a lot more of an ensemble in the earlier drafts. But I get a kick out of writing everybody. It's again that actor mentality, like each one. You're essentially playing it as the writer anyway. So it's like, oh, what role am I going to slip into for this scene? Like, it's just kind of, each one is its own challenge and each one is its own reward. I'm a Libra. I'm very difficult to answer favorite.
No. That's
I like it all.
Not a problem. You know what? I personally, as a person who does this on a semi-regular basis, I love the fact that you can ask somebody and get a different question and not everybody's coming up with the exact same rote answer. But yeah, I enjoyed that. Obviously, you get to do a lot of liberties with horror, but I felt like there was a lot of maybe research that went into this, certain storylines and stuff like that, certain things that weren't. And again, I'm trying not to give anything away. I'm trying not to do any spoilers because the book's still got a couple weeks to come out. But you did some different takes on a few what might be considered normal. I don't want to use the word tropes, but types of characters and things like that. Is there anything that... Who's that Pokemon? I forgot to turn that off. I'm going to turn that off. Is there anything that you, like, in your research and stuff like that, that you had to learn something maybe interesting, you know, not something you made up, but something that you actually based it off on that you found really interesting when you were putting this book together?
I love physical reality. I love body stuff, and not just from a horror angle, but just like, both of my parents were in the medical profession. I was raised with medical textbooks everywhere, and I used to just like sit and memorize. You know, I went, by the time I was like 7 years old, I had made my own flashcards of every bone and muscle in the body, and almost became a pathologist in college. Almost pursued that as an additional degree. So like, I love that stuff. Mary, my first book, is also like that. The main character is going through perimenopause, and it's very much about like that physical journey, which is different for everybody, but you know, kind of the hallmarks of that journey. And in this book, one of the main characters, Anna, is paraplegic, paralyzed from the waist down after a super freak accident during childbirth, billion to one shot. But it was fascinating to, you know, research how that injury can happen, because it can happen. It's a, you know, put a lot of air around the word can. It won't happen, but it can happen. It has happened to people. And, you know, much is made in the text of how rare this sort of thing is. So it was fascinating to speak with neurologists and gynecologists about, like, you know, how it could happen, why it would happen, what it would be like for it to happen, things like that. And then, you know, this book takes place almost a year after that occurred. So Anna has been in a wheelchair, or is using a wheelchair, for about 11 and a half months or so. So I also did a lot of research into what that is like. And you know, Anna is very purposefully a kind of, for lack of a better term, she's a bad disabled character. She's not used to it. She doesn't like it. She doesn't have experience with it. She's someone who's coming from like being a dancer and a personal trainer. Like, her coping mechanisms are all physical activity. And so this is very much affecting how she usually moves through the world emotionally. So she doesn't have her feet under her, so to speak. So I didn't have to like deal too much with researching people who have, you know, either used wheelchairs their entire life or are very comfortable with wheelchairs. I got to kind of put myself in her position and figure out like what it would be like to, you know, learn all this stuff, to be actively learning this stuff. And there are a ton of great YouTube pages and stuff like that for people who have recently been diagnosed paraplegic, or even just have like motor disability of some kind, even if it's like limited movement or something like that. And I got to watch a ton of videos. What makes YouTube so great is you get to actually like see it and see all the steps. And so I thought, I found that to be fascinating, and hopefully it reads empowering. Like, that was the goal, that, you know, we will watch this character get more and more comfortable with these, you know, again, for lack of a better term, like these limitations, these disabilities that she's not used to, and realize that they're not, you know, they're not going to actually like define her, that she can still be herself in this new dynamic. So yeah, that was all super great. And it made the process of drafting also really interesting, because, you know, I had sensitivity readers and I had beta readers and people who had, you know, certain disabilities and experience with being in a wheelchair and stuff like that. They had all given me their feedback, and that feedback had been incorporated, and there'd been several rounds of revisions and stuff like that. And even then, like, got to the final stage, got to the like layout pass of the manuscript, which is when your publisher really does not want you making any changes to the text whatsoever. And I caught a few things where I was like, you know what? I did not imagine this thorough enough. Like, this was me being, you know, this had my ableism blinders on, and I described Anna doing a thing that it would not be so simple, would actually like require a few additional steps. And if this book was going to honor her reality and her journey, we had to add, I had to mea culpa, you know, flagellate myself and be like, I'm sorry, I got to add like a paragraph or something like this. Cause otherwise it's just not going to, you know, anyone who actually uses a wheelchair would probably read that and be like, yeah, right, that sounds so easy for her to do that, but it's complicated.
No, I get it. I just wanted to tell you, one of the things I appreciate about Anna, and I don't have anybody in my life that's in a wheelchair or anything like that, but I think we see a lot of disabled people, and, you know, bless them, they fight everything with humor, and that's kind of their coping mechanism. And I think sometimes that helps us to feel comfortable right. about it. But with Anna, we get to see the fact that she's not comfortable with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, we get, I mean, sometimes we always want people to make happy so that we don't feel bad about things. And, you know, people deal with stuff in different ways. She's more than welcome to deal with it. However, I mean, she's a fake character, we know. But, you know, everybody's allowed to deal with it in their own way. And, you know, it doesn't always have to be something that makes us comfortable. Sometimes people should be allowed to struggle and express their frustration.
Yeah. So. Thank you for pointing that out. That was very important to me. Like I didn't want it to be a pat portrayal. I didn't want it to be, rosy. And like, it was kind of inspired by my throughout 2021 and for several months thereafter and there before, my wife was almost essentially bedridden with this really mystery chronic pain. She just couldn't move without just horrible agony. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's a long time to be dealing with. And she saw so many doctors. She wasn't getting like the right diagnosis. Nobody could figure out what it was until eventually they did. And she's in a much better place now. She's not dead. She's in a much better place. She's in a much better physical place. Yeah. So I had like firsthand front row seat to that process of somebody mourning their mobility. And you know, it is messy, and you're absolutely right. Like, I think a lot of fictional portrayals try and skip past that part so that like, mm-hmm. oh, let's not make it uncomfortable. Let's not make it like, anything icky or gross or anything like that. But what's nice about a horror novel and a novel in general is that we get to spend so much time in Anna's head and really see her, right. you know, have moments of triumph, have moments of resentment and depression. She's also dealing with postpartum depression, which is another thing we don't like deal with that mm-hmm. often in society. We kind of are like, okay, let's ignore that. That's also too complicated. So yeah, there are definitely chapters where she is just a mess, and she knows she's a mess. She doesn't want to be a mess, but like, this is what life is like right now. She can't pretend to be otherwise. I think it leads to a really interesting character dynamic.
It did. I love the characters in this. They were all very fleshed out. One of the things I did have, you know, for instance, the story of Anna Reed, it would be a totally different story, but their story could have been told in a different genre. Obviously, I feel like looking at some of your stuff, you love horror, but what about horror draws you to it?
Horror has been my like lifelong obsession. It's just kind of always been the lens that I view things through. I look at horror very philosophically, mm-hmm. as well as just like, it's the genre that I enjoy the most. Everything I kind of consume is horror. Everything I write, more or less, but mostly more, is horror. My plays are horror. Everything I wrote since I was a kid was horror. It's, I don't know, the less specific answer, I'll funnel it down, but the less specific answer is that to me, every good story is a horror story anyway, because all horror really means is that there's something the characters stand to lose that they really don't want to lose. Mm-hmm. So that could be, you know, Sleepless in Seattle could be a horror movie if they don't get together at the end and they're devastated and they have to like die alone. Like that's horrifying to contemplate. You know, then there are other stories that are a little more literal with the assignment, and it's mm-hmm. like, oh, you could lose your head or your life or your family member or the thing that you love. And then there are plenty of stories where, you know, ostensibly it's not horror, but it's about a character like realizing that the world isn't the way that they thought it was. And that's its own kind of horror. Like that's no different than a Lovecraftian elder god changing your conception of where humanity sits in the cosmos. Yeah, to me, every story worth telling is a horror story anyway. It's just that like the capital H horror genre yeah. likes to wear its metaphors on its sleeve a little bit more.
Yeah, you got to take that chance of losing your head to somebody without a head. You know, that type of thing.
Exactly. So. Exactly. And who hasn't been there? There's also there's an old joke that I think about a lot that Stephen King might have relayed at one point. That might be where I get it. I'm a lifelong Stephen King obsessive. Have been since I was like 7 years old. So a lot of his his marginalia has seeped into my subconscious. But so I don't remember I heard it from him or not. But there's an old joke of you come upon this man who's just banging his head on the wall repeatedly, 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 and he won't stop banging his head on the wall. And you ask him, hey, why are you doing that? And he says, well, it feels really good when I stop. And that's kind of what horror is as a genre too. Like it's this sort of like we read these horrible, horrible things and then we experience the mundane version of it. And it's like, oh, this doesn't feel so bad. Mm-hmm. Like this is actually kind of nice. At least I'm not being chased by, you know, a headless man with a machete.
They always have a machete, don't they? It's always a machete.
I mean, it's a very good chopping weapon.
Yeah, people ask less questions than if you pull like a bladed axe out of your, you know, double bladed axe.
Hurt your back that way.
Exactly. But it does open up the six pack real easy. So as I don't think I'd beat around the bush. I kind of mentioned it. This was a bit of what I considered a different take on the haunted house. Where was your inspiration for the, not for the, obviously the story of Reed and Anna as its own thing, but for the, let's say, capital H horror in this? Where was that coming from? Because like I said, you kind of blended some stuff together in a way that I at least hadn't seen before.
Yeah, thank you. I love that it hit you in a haunted house place, because that was not accidental, but it was kind of incidental in an interesting way. Like when I first had the idea for this story, which it's interesting you bring up They Will Outlive Us All, or mention They Will Outlive Us All, the horror movie that I was in 10 years ago at this point. Because that was a ton of fun. It's a great movie. I highly recommend it to people who enjoy like low budget horror comedy. It's just good, goofy fun. It's kind of two slackers fighting giant cockroaches in a New York apartment. And that was written by a good friend of mine, directed by a good friend of mine. So it was a very scrappy production, you know, filmed at another friend's apartment over like 2 weeks or something like that. It was exactly what you think an indie horror movie would be, and the experience of it. And I loved it so much. And, you know, I love these people too. And we worked together on a ton of stuff, not just this movie. But I was trying to think of like something that we could work on next. And the writer of They Will Outlive Us All and the co-star is a wonderful actress, Jessie Gatta, great writer as well. And so and we got like a lot of really good press for our dynamic together, our chemistry together as like platonic bumbling idiots. And I was like, okay, I want to write something that'll be for me and Jessie again, and we can set it in like another friend's apartment. So I was just trying to think of a good, you know, like two-hander horror story. And it occurred to me like, oh, okay, that'd be interesting if like a couple moves into an apartment building that turns out to not be what they're expecting. And so Nestlings was originally conceived as like a screenplay, like a low budget indie horror screenplay. And I never wound up writing it. Mm-hmm. I got maybe as far as like a paragraph treatment for it. So it just kind of, you know, disappeared in the ether for a while. But the pitch, when I pitched it to Nightfire, you know, I pulled out my movie treatment for it, the paragraph, and the comps that I used for the initial pitch that have continued through promotion and publication and all that stuff. The two titles to compare it to are Rosemary's Baby meets Salem's Lot. So it was never, it was only like as I was writing it that it took on that additional, like almost like Shining Overlook sort of haunted house vibe. Because from the outside in, it was always about just being a New York apartment building with flavors of Salem's Lot. And it wasn't until actually writing the manuscript and getting into the history of the building and stuff like that, that all that additional haunted house vibe sort of came through. So it was a nice little bonus. Now it's like Rosemary's Baby meets Salem's Lot and The Shining.
Which I get. No, once you said that, I can totally see it too. The whole Rosemary's Baby and Salem's Lot part.
Yeah.
I think I got hung up on, at least to me, the haunted house vibe.
Yeah. I love it.
But let's face it. I mean, you've got to have something living in the haunted house or unliving in the haunted house, you know, something. So that was perfect. Also, I'd have to say that I think there's probably a lot of people in New York that think that fighting off giant cockroaches in your apartment complex is not horror. That's just everyday life.
Oh, yeah. The other day, my wife and I had to remove a cockroach that was like that big from just right above our bed. It's not even cockroach season. And one just decided to say hi.
And once you remember that they can fly, they pretty much, nope, this is your room now. I'll be living here. Did any, and I feel like this is probably going to have an answer. Did any of this story surprise you? You started with something and you got somewhere where either the character was going to do something and you're like, no, they're going to do this. Or, you know, something was going to happen, but like, no, this is going to happen instead. Maybe it's like the story didn't go where you planned for it to go.
That's interesting. Because the easy answer is no, only because I'm a very like structure oriented writer. So I tend to have a good idea of what things are going to happen. Where the surprise tends to come in, for me at least, is in like the actual individual moments. And there have been times plenty of times where within those individual moments, then the structure starts to change or like an event will change. But I think with nestlings, most everything that I thought was going to happen happened, but it was those individual moments and like character payoffs and the things they said to each other and the ways they tried to hurt each other and stuff like that, that were surprising. You know, all these, when at least when I write a scene, like, you know, I tend to have an idea what it's going to be and what purpose it's going to serve. And, you know, again, that comes from like screenwriting and stuff like that. I'll know where I'm shooting the arrow, and it's just kind of waiting to see like what this attempt, how close this attempt takes me to the bullseye. But every now and then you'll find yourself, you know, being like, oh God, I didn't expect her to say that. Like, it might, sometimes it even moves the bullseye closer and you're like, oh God, like, I thought there was gonna have to be at least another scene before this gets dropped or this argument happens or something like that. And like, it's like, no, okay, this is happening right now. So that's always fun. But the shape didn't quite change, at least with this one. Mary changed a ton. Mary was me, you know, just kind of hacking with my machete, hacking through a dense overgrowth. But nestlings, I think because nestlings, you know, also was like stylized, or not stylized, but styled after these 70s pot boilers, like Rosemary's Baby, like Salem's Lot. Like, there, I had a much clearer idea of the structure at play. So there, yeah, there were less, so some things I was surprised when I cut them and I was like, oh, I didn't need that, which is always humbling. Yeah, everything kind of happened the way I hoped it would, which is always good. That's always gratifying. Sometimes you have an idea where things are going to go and you have to, you know, every time you try and make it happen, you have to like twist everybody around and make it really inorganic. And that's never good. That time, whenever that happens, you have to like go back and re-break something and like re-outline or something like that. But thankfully, Nestlings was pretty, it behaved pretty well.
Gotcha. Yeah, I do have to agree with you on some of the, I don't want to say conversations, some of the arguments that happened between Anna and Reed. Yeah, you had a couple of things in there where I'm like, oh, if I said that to my wife, yeah, I'd be dead. you're not walking back that one.
Yep. Some bells you can't unring.
Did have a question for you. How much did you kind of say, you kind of already answered this one. You said it was always planned on coming in October, kind of aiming for that Halloween slot. I feel like a lot of, you know, horror novelists would love that October slot, but not everybody gets it. Was that something that you pushed and they went with, or is that something that they wanted from the get-go, the publisher?
Yeah, that was just kind of a happy accident when, you know, they knew it was going to be like autumn of, what year are we, 2023? Yep. 2023. And then, you know, it just kind of, as the production schedule was rolling along, they found that they didn't have any books scheduled for that date. And we're like, okay, we'll do Nestlings for October 31st. I am thrilled to have a Halloween release. It feels very on the nose and very appropriate. There, I will say, there is part of me that is like, I wish we could have gotten like 2 weeks beforehand. Because Halloween is when like the normies stop paying attention to horror.
Yeah.
Like the horror audience will find it and embrace it whenever it comes out. But there are all these like lists that come out for people who don't dabble with horror that are like, here are books you can read for the spooky season. And Nestlings is just kind of waiting there out in the windows being like, well, I'll be there too one of these days. So it's a double-edged blessing.
Just, you know, get up early, October 31st.
Right.
Right to the bookstore.
You can read it in a day.
I think you could. I think the audio was like 13 hours.
Yeah.
But I mean, speed. Well, I mean, let's face it. If I read a book faster than I listen to a book.
Yeah.
And I think you have to, because when you read it, you see it, you comprehend it. When somebody's reading it to you, though, they've got to enunciate. Mm-hmm. They've got to put in the pauses and the drama and stuff like that when they're reading that you could have just read and just done it in your head and it'd be fine. Yeah. So, yeah, I would probably say if it takes me 13 hours to listen to it, you're probably right, about 6 hours. You could do that if that was your Halloween plan.
Although I will say the reader of the audiobook is phenomenal.
Yes. So
I highly recommend people also check out the audiobook. And then I read the afterword at the end. So you get to hear my dumb voice again.
Well, I'm not blowing smoke. I think you got a great voice. That just me.
Hey, thanks. I'm classically trained.
Well, you did. who was that? Our Alan Tudyk. You've seen that outtake where he's doing the voice of that stupid chicken from...
Oh, yeah.
And then he just looks at it, he's like, I went to Juilliard. I'm doing chicken flexes.
Okay. Check didn't bounce.
One thing I did want to, it's not in the questions that I talked to you about earlier because I thought about it afterwards. It's not really a question either. It's just kind of a, something that I noticed. And I'm like, this had to be in purpose, obviously. Your cast of characters that that I obviously don't remember all their names to because I listened to it. But you've got an actor, actress. You've got a musician. You've got a novelist. I don't feel like that was done on accident.
So, hey, write what you know, right?
Exactly. I thought you had a little fun in there. I appreciated that.
My next book, the one that I'm revising right now, the protagonist is an improv comedian. So that'll be a challenge to see who can relate to her.
Gotcha. Are you going to be doing any practice for that? Or are we going to see you out of the funny bone?
I used to love improv. And I used to be pretty good at it. And then I stopped doing it like freshman or sophomore year of college. And like, I've always loved sketch comedy and I kind of fell into doing more sketch comedy. And then ever since then, I hate doing improv. I appreciate improv, but I hate doing it. So I should like start taking some classes again. Cause I, as a commercial actor, like I do a fair amount of commercials and stuff like that. Those always want to have improv or improv experience. And I just, my writer brain kicks in when it comes time to improv and I start thinking of all the scenarios and I freeze up and I'm like, well, does that make sense characterologically? And should I do that? What would be the most interesting thing to do? And you can't do that when you improv, you just got to go. So I should get some training again. So maybe I'll see you at the funny bone.
Always sucks to come up with a perfect line. By that time, the moment has passed. It's like, well, crap. Yep. If I say it now, it's going to just sound stupid.
The spirit of the staircase, they call it.
Exactly. So here's another thing. Since we talked about your three careers, for lack of a better term, got a lot of authors, you know, the work-life balance, either because, you know, a brand new author ain't paying the bill. So, you know, they've got the full-time job and they're still trying to find time to write, or, you know, you've got some that just have a big career and they want to keep it. With you having these kind of three different things going around, like I said, you're done now, but you were writing the album. Sorry. You're writing the book. Obviously you just finished up with that. You've got all the screenplays that you do. Do you find that you manage to keep all of those balls up in the air at once? Or do you have to say like, okay, right now I need to finish Nestlings. Everything else is going to have to take a back seat. This is my focus.
It's a little bit of both. I also have a full-time job on top of everything. And, you know, there are a few other things that I do just kind of for fun. And it's a challenge. I mean, I try and be as disciplined as I can. You know, I write every day, usually in the morning, and usually that's like the prose related stuff, because I find I can do like screenwriting later in the day, even if I'm like a little more tired. But like generative prose and like making words sound good, I kind of have to do as soon as I wake up, because then like everything gets cluttered and I can't hear it as well. And music I love doing, you know, usually at night. That's usually when that kicks in. So that is sort of helpful. Each discipline has like a different biorhythm. But yeah, there will usually come a point in any project, be it a script, be it a play script, be it a novel, what have you, where it will reach a sort of tipping point where that's what I have to focus on until it's done. And that's usually like later on in the process. It's usually like as it's maturing as a thing. But I also find that like that's the moment when I don't mean it to sound as woo-woo as this sounds, but like maybe I do, I don't know. I feel like that's the moment where like you start to like pick up on cues that you might not have noticed before. Like someone will say a thing and you'll be like, oh, that can go in this thing. Or you'll see something to be like, that's a great detail that I can use for this thing. The universe starts like contributing to a fuller picture of the thing you're working on. And if you're juggling too many things, then you lose out on that. Then as opposed to when you're like focusing on one thing and looking at everything through that lens. So a thing will usually take primacy at some point in the process. And the good thing about that too is then you're closer to that being done and you can move on to the other things you were working on.
So the next one, I kind of put this one together, but I'm going to separate them out because I think it'll be easier to handle them one by one. So let's start with musician. First and foremost, because I skipped it in the, we kind of blew through the intro there because you realized how long it was going to be.
you're listing theaters. We gotta keep talking.
But album number one, I love the name, Pet Sematary. By the way, just had to throw that out there since we didn't cover it. You've already kind of answered the part where you've finished writing them. Do you know, for instance, when you might be sitting down and recording? I think the eye said it all.
I will say, so my Pet Sematary, I recorded that in college. That's an old album. That was like 2002. Then the next one was like 2004. So I haven't like recorded a proper album in 20 years almost. There are at least three full albums of material, maybe even more for follow-ups. And honestly, I could record them all like tomorrow if I wanted to. And I do want to, and I kind of intend to. Part of it is like a psychological thing where I need to remember that I love lo-fi music as a listener, because when I record music, I get so hung up on like, oh, I got to have the right gear and I got to, you know, build time for tracking every track and making sure that, like, you know, I got to record the guitar part and the bass part and the percussion part. And, you know, I don't have a keyboard anymore, so I got to find like a piano that I can play. And like, what if I want to put horns on a thing, or, you know, the vocals and backup vocals and all that stuff. And I got to remember that, like, you know, I could just do this with me and a guitar if I want to fucking lo-fi it.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I will have very clear moments when I realize, oh, that's going to be my plan. I'm going to do that. I'm just going to record these songs and then I'm just going to, you know, release it on Bandcamp or whatever. Music is the one thing that I do that I'm not like actively trying to make money off of, because it's kind of impossible these days anyway.
Yeah.
It's kind of just for the passion of it. And then almost invariably, I will start recording the first song I want to record, and then I'll be like, okay, that's great. But I'm going to use that as a scratch track, and I'm going to start like recording some other guitar parts and start recording other instrument parts. And then, you know, 20 years go by. So I need to just like the mic setup I have, or the mic setup I have for audiobooks and stuff like that, I've just got to like sit down and record them and then get them out. One of my dearest friends, who's also, we've been in several bands together, and he's a brilliant musician, phenomenal songwriter, great singer and guitarist. He's in the same boat, and it took until the pandemic, and even then it took until like 2022 for him to finally be like, I'm at home all the time. Like, I need to record this album. And he did it, and it sounds amazing. And so, like, that was very inspiring to me. I am going to take him as an example and get them out sooner rather than later.
Gotcha.
But that's about as specific as I can be.
Well, I have to say, I did not realize that Nat Cassidy and the Nines, you were all nine of them, it sounds like.
Yeah. Actually, the Nines is kind of modeled after John Lennon's Plastic Ono Band, which they're... you know, he had session players and some very famous musicians that would, record with Plastic Ono Band records. But the general prevailing thought was, anyone who wants to be in the band is in the band. So everyone is a nine, as far as I'm concerned.
Gotcha.
Everybody gets to be part of the Nines. If you want to play on a Nines record, great.
I haven't played a piano in 30 years. I don't think you want me on the Nines record.
The same 88 keys.
I'll be doing chopsticks in the back. It'll be fine. You can stop me if you can't say anything, because I still have no idea what's going on with SAG right now. Do you have anything in the pipeline, a show coming out, a movie coming out, a Broadway play coming out?
No, I as an actor, I'm still on strike. I can do like commercial work and stuff like that. Commercials aren't affected. That's a different contract. And I am recording an audio drama right now with my dear friends at Gideon Media, who did Steel the Stars.
Yes.
and done many things with them as an actor, as a co-producer and all that stuff. They're all very dear friends. We were all playwrights together back in the day. But we're recording a new show. I don't know if they've released what the show is about, so I don't know if I can say that, but it's a ton of fun. It's going to be great. And we're like, probably halfway through the recording process of that, so that should be in the can by like November. And then however long it takes to do post-production and stuff like that. So that will be fun. That is something I'm like actually getting to do. But other than that, I'm just working on the next book. And now that the writer strike is over, you know, there's some other like spec projects and meetings and stuff like that that can happen again, including the book that I'm writing that comes out in 2025. My film and TV reps think it's a slam dunk as a movie, so they want me to adapt it as a screenplay as I'm writing the next draft of the novel. So I'm kind of doing that concurrently, and that's keeping me busy.
I can't even remember actually put that into question, but it'd be the perfect time to put in here. When I was reading Nestlings, and we're listening, I had the advanced listening copy, which is, thank you to Libro FM, by the way, that's how I managed to get that early. I really thought that as I was reading this, as I got farther and farther into it, you know, I know they're going to chop some stuff up and everything else, but I felt like I could see your screenwriting in it. I could see that as a, maybe you do like a little bit longer miniseries type thing, but you know, Tales of the Crypt, Outer Limits, Twilight Zone, it felt like this would translate very easily to TV.
Thank you. Yeah, I think so too. I mean, most of the stuff I write, I think tends to be kind of unavoidable, because I'm a dramatic, you know, capital D dramatic writer by training and by inclination. We weren't able to have any discussions and stuff like that while the writer strike was happening, so those are just starting to trickle in, and you know, so it's nothing I can tease too clearly, but Mary is optioned. Mary is actually optioned by NBC Universal for miniseries, because I feel like that is the, I love that format for horror storytelling. It's such a challenge to break horror for TV when there's no end in sight, because most horror stories are building to an ending. Like, that's kind of where the horror comes from, the ultimate horror. So to have, like, you know, that sort of Mike Flanagan, like, six episode sort of structure is pretty ideal. And I feel like Nestlings has a scope to it, but if you want to be like brutal about it, you might be able to make Nestlings a feature, but hopefully it'll be able to breathe.
Yeah, I almost think that, like, they're going to have to take too much out.
Yeah.
The last book that I really liked the movie, because let's face it, I mean, most people, if you like the book, they're like, don't watch the movie, was probably The Martian.
Yeah, that was a good adaptation.
I thought that the stuff that they changed for the movie and the stuff that they cut out either had to be or was going to be like a 72-hour movie. but that they actually, I thought that they got the gist of it right. And I think a lot of times too much stuff gets to cut out when you're trying to get it all in 2 hours. And I feel like we're almost living in a perfect world for this right now because of the things like HBO and Netflix and Amazon Prime. Some of those like 6 to 8 episode seasons are becoming a thing now. Yeah. That used to be something like Roots was like, you'd see that once in like 3 years or something. Miniseries were not a thing. Now it's almost a standard.
Yeah, and they're great. And you know, everybody cancels a show after the first season anyway. So just have it be a standalone season. It's wonderful.
Yeah, that's when it goes really well. And then all of a sudden they're like pressuring you to come out with the second season. They're like, but I told the story.
There could be a sequel to Nestlings, I guess.
There could be a sequel to Nestlings. Yeah. But yeah, I found a lot of times the horror, and especially I used to hate short stories just because, like, if a story was really good, I wanted to read the rest. It was like, I need another one. And I think I've finally gotten to the point, I've read enough like really good short stories and stuff now where I'm like, no. The story was told. It was told in however many words it needed to be told in.
Yep.
And somebody's going to have to stretch to get a second story out of this. And I'm always worried about getting that bad sequel, which is, let's face it, the standard, the bad sequel. But yeah, like I said, I would, if somebody gets Nestlings, I don't know anybody, I'm just letting you know, if somebody wants to get Nestlings and option it, I would definitely watch that, because I think it'd
be
good.
We got one viewer.
We'll get one viewer. Which actually tied back into another question. I think I skipped it. Obviously, if it was going to come out, and if you wanted to, I could totally see you as Reed.
I would play Reed.
Yeah. Who in your mind, we're not signing any contracts here, people. Who in your mind do you see as Anna? And again, there's no contract, so you could go some, I'm not saying we'd want Catherine Zeta-Jones in that role, but is there somebody that you're like, you know, that would be a good Anna?
I know you gave me this question in advance and I forgot to like think of choices. It's an interesting question, because like as you just said, like I would love to play Reed. I feel like Reed would be in my wheelhouse as an actor, but I'm also too old to play Reed. feel like I'm too old. Maybe I could get away with it. But Reed's like in his 30s. Anna's in her 30s.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a challenge. Let's see. We'll do... Let's mess with the Marvel fan base, and we'll have Zendaya and Tom Holland. We'll have Peter Parker and Mary Jane Watson as Anna and Reed, because they got great chemistry. I like them together.
They do.
Yeah. So let's do that. We'll sign them up. They seem the right age.
They're definitely the right age, and I feel like Tom Holland might surprise me, but I think I've seen him in too many things where he's got kind of that humor going on that I don't feel like Reed's got going on.
Yeah.
And I feel like Zendaya would take the "I'm mad about this" way too to heart. Okay, sorry. I just officially made sure Zendaya will never be on the podcast. Apologize. But yeah, I love it. And I don't think you're too old, to be honest with you. At least you've got the look. You've got the look. You know, I think you could play somebody younger.
When they paint out the grays, I should be able to.
Well, I'm 52, and you know the grays all came in early, and that's the ones that haven't left. So,
of course,
yeah. People have been asking me to buy them, you know, alcohol since I was 17. It's like, I can't buy you cigarettes. Leave me alone. I know. I just look old. But I think you'd make a good read. And let's face it, you'd definitely be like, I know exactly what this character's thinking.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's been humbling, because Reed is not based on me at all. But he is kind of based on some of like the darkest moments and the worst inclinations of when I found myself in a caretaking position. Like, I think Reed means totally well. And none of this is like a spoiler or anything like that. I think right away you get the sense that like he's not someone emotionally equipped with being the caregiver in a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And he's trying his best. But there are so many reviews where people are like, I hate Reed with a passion. I hated him from the first chapter. And I'm like, oh no.
Like, no, I don't.
Fired by me.
I don't think I hated him from the first chapter. I felt, to get back to you, the thing you said where it kind of meets The Shining, I feel like as the story goes along, it's not just what Reed and Anna are experiencing together, but I also feel like, again, the building is having an effect on them. And I feel like you kind of see that progression. So I didn't hate Reed from the get-go. You hate Reed by the end. But yes, I did not hate him at the beginning.
Good, thank you.
What else we have? I was trying to think if there's anything else, because again, don't want to give away too many spoilers. I will tell anybody, like I said, this is not, to me, I know some people have different levels. To me, this is not a long read. No pun intended.
Thank you.
It's not quite the, you know, it's not a summer romance, you know, by the beach. I can read it in 3 hours, but it's also not McCammon's swan song at 1,100 pages definitely. Either.
The trade edition comes out to like 280 pages or something, like 289 before the afterword. So yeah,
to me, that's short. Yeah. To me personally.
I agree. I again, like speaking as like a diehard Stephen King fan, I have behind my computer a list of everything he's ever written organized by word count. It's just kind of a LARF that I like to refer to every now and then. And Mary, the criticisms that Mary got, its reception was incredibly warm and gracious and all that stuff. But when there were criticisms, it was usually people saying like, this book is too long, or just even people who liked it would just like objectively say like, this is a really long book. And Mary is 130,000 words. It's 400 pages, which nowadays is actually, a long book. But like, when you grow up on like the books that we grew up on, like it's like as long as Firestarter. Nobody thinks of Firestarter as a long Stephen King book. Like 130,000 words, that's a pot boiler.
I know. Yeah. It's like for me, it's like perfect. But I'll be honest with you. I don't know if you know this, and I don't, like, this is not a stat. This is just, I used to work at a bookstore, a lot of book clubs. And I have found that for whatever reason, even book clubs, which are supposed to be, you know, people who love reading, I'm assuming, unless they're just there for the wine, 300 pages is about the limit where if I see, especially if it's a little old lady grabbing her book for the book club and she opens it up and it's over 300 pages, she starts to pause. Like, I don't know if I want to read a 300-page book. I love them. I've had, you know, I grew up on Count of Monte Cristo.
Right.
Read a lot of that stuff. And like I said, Robert McCammon, I'm sure you at least know the name. Swan Song.
Robert McCammon.
I mean, let's face it, Swan Song, halfway through that 1,100-page book, you actually turn to a page and it's like book two. I'm like, yeah, this is pretty much two books slammed into one. But yeah, you are in the sweet spot. I don't know if there's a lot of horror book clubs out there, but you're right in that thing. And I think too, though, with the book club, and maybe that's why the 300 is a good number, is it's a book club. You've got to read it. It's almost like an assignment.
Yeah.
There's something about joining a book club where you're like, oh, I'm going to get to read all these books. And at some point it becomes, oh, I have to read all these books.
Yeah.
But yeah, any book
you're
clubs out there.
Last week anyway.
Yeah, if you're a horror, if you like horror and you're a book club, this page count's in the sweet spot. It's perfect. What do we got? If anything, I think I've kind of gone off all the other stuff that I was about the book, again, mainly to avoid spoilers, because there were so many things. I'm like, if I bring this up, I'm going to bring up something else, and then I got to stop. So for the regular everyday stuff, I ask every author whether you care about it or not. What are you reading right now?
Right now, I am reading a couple of things. I tend to read one thing physical, one thing audio, one thing e, and then like usually there's like a graphic novel in there too, and I can't look at prose anymore. The book that happens to be sitting right here that I'm reading is Tyler Jones's Midas.
Oh, okay.
Tyler Jones is phenomenal, and he's such a lovely human being too. And this book, I think, just came out like last week or something like that. It's a very limited edition. Earthling Press is putting it out, so it's this beautiful, like, it's got illustrations that are lovely, and it's a very limited run. But if you he's got a bunch of other stuff, and he's got a novella coming out soon as well. So anything Tyler does, I think, is fantastic. And he's really great. I highly recommend him. And I'm listening to Fever House by Keith Rawson. That is a ton of fun. That's like if Pulp Fiction were a horror movie, and like a gonzo horror movie. I'm about like an hour into that audiobook, and it's interesting. It's narrated by Exe Sands, who is a phenomenal, very popular audiobook narrator, and she has a kind of style that she's known for, where she has like a very like kind of wry, sort of like sarcastic, but you know, sort of like lower on the energy dynamic sort of vibe. So she's not like a big expressive voice like I have. She kind of like sits back and has this like smirk in her read sometimes. And this story is just balls to the wall action, and just crazy, like, you know, hitmen bickering and killing people and finding horrible things and all that stuff. And you wouldn't think it works, but the marriage between that voice and that that text is so great.
Nice.
It's so additionally funny. So I highly recommend that. I just read, I'm like in the middle of volume 5 of the graphic novel, Something is Killing the Children, which I'm enjoying.
Sounds vaguely familiar. I haven't read it, but it sounds familiar.
Yeah, it seems to be pretty popular. The people that have read it and loved it talk about it a lot. And I feel like it's relatively new, too, or like, you know, the past couple of years. So you've probably seen it pop up. But I'm digging it. And I think I'm reading some other stuff, too.
Gotcha. You caught me chuckling there. I wasn't laughing at you just when you started to say that. I've got a book, I've got an ebook, I've got an audio book, I've got a comic book. If I'm not reading 4 books at a time, I'm not doing it right. I do have to find, as much as I love fantasy novels, I can't do 2 fantasy novels at the same time.
Yeah.
Because of the fantasy names.
Right.
I'm like, and I'll get some that's like, these names are so alike and I don't remember who's in which one. So
right.
I got to keep the genres separate, but yeah, I've always got 4 going.
And like writing projects, almost inevitably one will finally take over and be like, I got to finish this one. Like, I got to put everything aside.
Yeah. You get close to one where it's like, it starts to get to that wrap up point and you're hooked and you're like, okay, this one's going to be taking first place for a little while. Right. You may have already kind of answered this question. Maybe not. I know you seem to like the Tyler book, but however, that may not be an exact match. If somebody enjoys Nestlings, what else do you think they should read? Not like 50 books, but just like something. It's like, if you like Nestlings, you're going to like this, if you can think of anything.
Oh, man, I had an answer for this, and I forgot to write it down. So now what? Oh, what was it? Oh boy, I totally picked it out this afternoon and now I'm blanking. Yeah, apologies to the writer. I thought I was going to plug.
It's all good.
Let's say Clay McLeod Chapman's What Kind of Mother just came out a couple of weeks ago. And that is a very different book,
mm-hmm.
but is also about parenthood and loss and grief. And it is bananas. It is so good and weird. It might be my favorite book of Clay. I've read everything Clay's written too. He's a close buddy of mine. We both came up in the theater scene also in New York. But this might be my favorite of his so far. And it's wild. You will not be able to predict where it's going or what it's doing. And it has two parts that are also like some of the most emotionally devastating and mm-hmm. engaging segments in anything I've read in recent memory. So I highly recommend that. What Kind of Mother, it's called.
To tie that in, I didn't mention it earlier, but I was kind of thinking about it and you were talking about that. The job you did on Anna's reaction at the end, and that's all I'm going to say about that. The way the novel finishes, Anna, everything from what she wants to do, what she has to do, what she needs to do, and the twisting of the heart for all three of those together. Perfect. Just going to throw that out there.
Oh, thank you so much. That means a lot. Thank you. Oh, I remember who I was going to plug. Liz Caron's Night's Edge is also, that is a vampire novel, but it's a great book about mother-daughter dynamics.
Gotcha.
It's phenomenal. Nestlings is not a vampire novel, but I do describe it as vampire adjacent. So if you're in that mood after Nestlings, Night's Edge by Liz Caron is also fantastic.
Perfect. Yeah.
Two for one.
2 for 1. We got a 2 for 1 today. Also, and I haven't found an author yet who doesn't have one, any sort of independent bookstore that you want to give a shout out to.
Yeah, why not? I also used to work at a bookstore. I used to work at an indie bookstore in the Village in New York. That was one of my first jobs in the city, which is no longer really with us. The location that I was at is with us anymore. So this is not that store, but the book launch for Nestlings is going to be at this store, and it's a great store, and it just moved to a new location, and it's in my neighborhood. So I'm a big fan. It's the Astoria Bookshop.
Oh, okay.
Which is in Astoria, Queens, and it's lovely, and they're run by lovely people, and I could plug like 5 other indie bookshops, but I won't.
It's one of those things, like if you get a list too long, then somebody wants to know why they're left off, so
yeah,
I get
exactly.
It.
So I'll stick with Astoria, because they're hosting me.
Well, yeah.
On Halloween.
A bit of the Waldorf Astoria, so you know.
It's kind of similar.
Yeah.
A little smaller.
A little bit, yeah. Do you have, obviously, people, they know you're a musician, they know you're a writer, they know you're an actor. Is there any skill you have that maybe nobody does know about that you just kind of think like, hey, this is what I do when I don't think anybody's looking?
That's such a good question, and it's such a funny question. I don't think I've ever been asked that before. I almost was going to say no. But yeah, I'm really fucking good at the New York Times crossword puzzle. I'm really good at it.
No, that's fine.
That's a private thing. Like nobody sees me doing it, but I'm really good at it.
I just find it like it's a fun question because you get a whole range of answers, you know, baking, yeah, gardening. I've heard a lot of stuff all over the place. Still waiting for somebody to say they have a black belt in ninjutsu, but I haven't gotten to it yet. It'll be fine.
I got to camouflage belt in taekwondo when I was a kid.
Oh, nice.
Which I don't even know if it's a real belt. But it was between green and brown.
Yeah, I think I got to yellow in karate. So, you know, you're still going to kick my butt.
the earth tones, they're all about the same.
And then the last one, any question that you, as an author, were expected to maybe get asked but didn't come up?
No, I think you nailed them all. Like this was a great chat.
I appreciated it. Did see a few people in and out of the chat, but everybody's apparently being quiet today and shy. So just going to let you know that this will be, it's late on a Wednesday night, and it's actually my son's birthday today, but we're going out tomorrow because of work.
Oh, happy birthday today.
Exactly. Appreciate it. But yeah, we're going to, it's probably going to be this weekend before I get this edited. Just kind of make, you know, I get rid of all my ums and ahs and everything. Basically, I make myself look better. That's the entire point. I'll get this up to YouTube. It's going to have links to your, all your social, your website, links to any books that we mentioned. I'll have links to the bookstores. Some of the stuff that we can't do in a live stream, but we'll get those in there for the video that'll end up on YouTube. Also, probably I like to do is I like to put up little, I don't want to call them promos, but like we'll have a question answer, and you know, obviously you can sit down and watch the whole thing, but I'll also shoot out some like 60 seconds, like I'll ask, you know, questions and answers and stuff like that. I am not worried about people coming on to see me. I want them to hear something you said and say like, crap, I gotta go check out that book. So
Who the fuck is that guy?
Dude, I'm telling you, I was going through the list of shows that you'd been on, and like some of them, like The Following, some of them are some of my favorites.
I'm glad to hear some Following love. That show had a small but passionate fan base.
Yes, it was. Well, yeah, you love horror. It's right up your, it's right in your alley. But yeah, that it's one of those ones where I almost kind of glad it ended where it did, because I didn't want them to, I didn't want it to jump the shark.
Yeah.
I think young people still know what that means, but yeah, it was such, especially that first couple of seasons and stuff like that. That story was just like, oh my word, where are they going to go with this next?
I'm in a very pivotal episode of that too. So you definitely saw my character.
I'm going to have to go back and rewatch it now. But let's face it. I mean, you can, everybody's got that. You'll see something and you'll like watch them. It's like, hey, they look familiar. And then you go back and someday you'll be watching something else. I'm like, I've seen him before. It's like, just totally didn't realize who it was.
What's wild is I've been like the bad guy of the week in most of the procedurals that film in New York, uh-huh. So, you know, Law and Order, Blue Bloods, Bull, you know, all of those. And, you know, like guest star, like a big mm-hmm. role in it. I still will usually hear from people, and like all of these shows are like syndicated, and so like they're running on like motel TVs and stuff like that. Like people could see them. I will invariably get people saying, oh, I saw you on The Affair the other day, which is a show that is not still running, and I'm in that for like maybe 45 seconds of screen time, and I there's no coverage of my face whatsoever. I'm in a couple long shots and I have a couple of like off-camera lines, and
gotcha.
For some reason feel compelled to let me know that they saw me on The Affair, which barely,
well, you know, hey, it's at least it's not the Joey cameo on that on his first acting thing. I don't know, you probably did you ever watch Friends?
Yeah, the VD poster.
He's like, oh. And then he's like, his first thing is like, he was in that one show. He's like, you were? He's like, yep, there I am. Oh, there I am. Oh, there right. I am.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, that's all we're going to say about that. But it was hilarious.
Yeah, I remember that.
but yeah, it's kind of funny what people recognize you. And once you know who somebody is, then of course you see them all the time. It's like, and everything that you're in is like,
That guy.
I've seen so many movies where at the time, especially like somebody's their first acting thing, didn't think anything of it. And then years later, I will completely have forgotten they were in a show and I'll watch it again. I'm like, what's that stupid one? Peggy Sue Got Married. And a freaking Jim Carrey was in it.
Right.
But at the time, nobody knew who Jim Carrey was. Didn't stick. He was just the silly guy. So, Perfect. Going to wrap this up. We've gone a little bit longer than usual, but I don't care. I thought we had a great talk. I enjoyed it. You're a very good interview, by the way.
Hey, thank you. You know, as are you.
Authors, you know, there's some authors that, you know, they like to write. They don't want to get in front of the camera. They like to write. So, you know, some people are just, you know, talk easier. You're an actor. You definitely a little more polished, but absolutely.
You're also catching me after I did a podcast a couple of days ago, and like halfway through it, I was just like, "What the fuck am I doing?" Like, all my answers were so rambly and trailing off. So you caught me feeling more disciplined. I was like, "I need to like end my answers, and I need to be more concise in the things I say." So it's good. I'm practiced again.
It sounds like you've been talking to my wife, because that's what she tells me all the time. It's like, you're rambling. Sorry, dear. I'll shut up now. All right, but no, totally appreciate it. We'll get that out there. I will let you know. I'll shoot you an email once the video's out there, just in case, you know, you want to go check it out or anything.
I'll spread it around.
For anybody who is, well, you are probably going to be watching this hopefully on YouTube later. November 4th, I've got Jim Butcher coming up. And then after that, I've got some people I've talked to, but nobody with a date. So I don't like to say anything until I've got an actual date because things can change. But once again, go out there, check out Nat's book. I'm going to have to check out Mary too, because if it's as good as Nestlings was, it's definitely worth it. Anybody who's worried about, you know, the super long book like that, this is not it. I will tell you, anybody interested in Libro FM, not a sponsor, but Libro.fm, they're actually a little bit cheaper than Audible if you pre-order right now. Doesn't happen very often, but they are. B, as I like talked about the fact, I do love my independent bookstores. Libro.fm does allow you to pick a bookstore, and they give just a little slice of that profit to them. So that's it. That's all I'm saying. They're not sponsored, so yeah. All right.
And if you like audiobooks, the audiobook of Mary, I almost recommend more than the print edition, because the narrator of Mary does a brilliant job and is like across the board everywhere is kind of lauded as the perfect narrator for Mary. So gotcha. I highly recommend that audiobook as well.
Yeah, I always wanted to call them readers before, but I'm going to say it's probably voice actors. Is that the proper term for the person who reads the book out loud?
Yeah, narrator.
I don't think some of them get enough credit.
Big time.
Because I mean, you find a really, really good one. Nobody knows who's like, yeah, somebody read that audiobook. It's like, but yeah, you get a good, some of them just like make the book so much better.
Agreed.
All right. But again, to my wife's point, I'm rambling. So thanks again, Nat. I'll try to keep in touch. Can definitely let you know what I think about Mary when I get to it. Thank everybody who poked their heads in, even if they were not the most talkative audience today. But that's fine. Some people just want to come hear things. They don't want to talk. And Halloween's coming up. You've got a book to buy. You have an assignment. That's all I'm saying. All right. Thank you much.